Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com, movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley and I'm super excited for this week's show because we're putting on old-timey clothes and we're going to go live in the woods to talk about M. Night Shyamalan's 2004 feature The Village, which means I'm joined for this very special episode by Rosalie Lewis. Hi, Rosalie.
Hi, Patrick.
How are you?
I am fantastic.
Good. Are you excited to talk about this movie?
I could not be more excited.
I feel like we talked about it on a past show for a couple minutes.
Yeah, it did come up for a couple minutes. I think it was on the
Fast
show.
Times, we were talking
about Fast Times, maybe? Yeah.
But now we're devoting a whole episode to it.
Yes.
This is exciting, I guess.
It's very exciting, for me at least. I don't know if anybody else is as big a fan of The Village as I am, but we'll find out.
We will find out. I tweeted something about it this past weekend when I was watching it and was surprised at the amount of positive feedback.
Okay.
So I think the tide is turning a little bit on The Village.
I hope so.
We shall see.
Yes.
But before we get to The Village, I have to ask this question. Have you seen anything good lately?
I have seen some good things lately,
Woo-hoo!
Patrick.
Yay! I'm so glad I asked.
I've seen some not so good things also, but I'm not going to talk about them.
You can talk about those if you want.
Well, let's not waste our time. I would first like to talk about Super Cop, a.k.a. Police Story 3. There's
very nice.
Many different names and also apparently several different movies called Super Cop. So don't get too confused. But I'm talking about the one that has Jackie Chan and Michelle Yeoh and Maggie Chung.
Academy Award winner, Michelle Yeoh.
Indeed. This is the one from 1992. So in case you're looking for, you know, the correct release. And I was inspired to watch this really because of Michelle Yeoh winning the Academy Award. I realized that I've seen some of her work, but I haven't seen a lot of her, you know, back catalog where it was much more action oriented.
Yeah.
And wow, what a treasure. Like, that movie is so awesome.
It's really fun.
It's really a showcase for her. I think Jackie Chan, of course, is always going to be, you know, a standout, but she really wowed me with all the stunts that she does. And she really, like, puts him in his place and gives him some guff, which was fun to watch. They have great chemistry in the movie, and it's, you know, just a classic. Like, it has a little bit of zaniness, but it also has some serious moments of, like, people being shot at point-blank range, which
right.
I was not expecting in a Jackie Chan movie. I just always kind of make the probably false assumption that they're going to be a little silly.
Right.
Or at least not, like, deadly serious.
Well, to be fair, the only other Jackie Chan movie you've seen is The Tuxedo, correct?
Sure. Yeah. Actually, I did watch that in the last few months. It's pretty fun.
I've never seen it.
You should.
All right.
If you like Jennifer Love Hewitt.
She's fine.
Yeah.
What's the Claire Forlani one? The Medallion? Is that right?
Yeah, which that one I haven't seen yet.
And what's the one where he's babysitting kids?
Shoot. I know the name of it. It has baby in the name somewhere.
Okay.
But it's not Baby Geniuses.
No, it's not Mr. Nanny. That's Hulk Hogan.
Right. And it's not Kindergarten Cop. No, we'll figure it out.
But we will. Or
we'll look it up. but yeah, Super Cop, very fun. Stanley Tong is the director. He's done a bunch of the, you know, Jackie movies. And it was really fun seeing the younger versions of people like Maggie Chung and Michelle Yeoh, where, you know, Maggie Chung barely gets, I mean, she doesn't get to talk too much. She has a key role as the girlfriend of Jackie Chan's character, but he's undercover most of the time, so they don't really talk too much. And yeah, she's super, super young in it. And, you know, knowing she'll go on to do all this stuff with Wong Kar-wai and all the more dramatic roles, it was kind of novel to see her in this more kind of frivolous, almost throwaway role. But she really brings a lot of heart to it. So I enjoyed that.
Nice. Where do you watch that?
On Blu-ray from Half Price Books.
Oh, nice. I think that Blu-ray is out of print, so I think that's hard to come by.
It was a double feature, and I can't remember now what the other, it's another Jackie Chan movie.
Okay.
Can't remember what the other one was, but yeah, they happened to have it. We grabbed it, and
nice.
Life was better.
That's a good find.
It was. So I have to confess, I haven't seen Police Story 1 or 2, but we own the Criterions.
Nice.
So at some point, I will watch those.
They're good.
This one was more pressing because of the Michelle Yeoh of it all.
Right,
so
right.
I definitely want to watch more of her stuff, and maybe I'll finally tackle Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, because I've still not seen that one.
Okay.
So that's probably next on my list.
Nice.
In much more serious territory.
Mm.
I also was exposed for the very first time to the wonders that are the Lizzie McGuire movie from 2003.
Okay.
I hope that this is going to be on one of Adam's 2K replays because
oh, it might be.
It could be, right? It is 20 years old, which is kind of baffling and crazy to think about. Yeah, so one of my coworkers is a little younger than me, and she knows that I love movies, and she was like naming all these Disney movies that I hadn't seen of the 2K era.
Right, era.
This being one of them, exactly. Okay. And so I went over to her house and watched that and Megan, the horror movie Megan. So that was an interesting double feature.
Yeah.
Two different types of girl power.
So I never watched Lizzie McGuire.
Me neither.
I never saw the movie.
You're fine, but it was fun, and it, like, I can see how this influenced, you know, the younger people that watched it. It does have some fun little, like, animated sequences, which I know is also something that happened in the TV show.
Okay.
And, we really enjoyed all the really horrible fashion choices that were made in the movie inadvertently because it was the 2000s.
Right.
Lots of lowrider pants, lots of clashing patterns.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, some very interesting hair extensions. And the basic plot of this movie is Lizzie McGuire goes on her eighth grade trip, goes to Rome for 2 weeks, which I'm sure that happens in most eighth grade trips. And she basically, like, falls for this handsome guy on a motorcycle or a Vespa or whatever who is a pop star who thinks she looks just like his...
I sing him a song.
Yeah. And he thinks she looks just like his co-star, Isabella. They look the same, except she has blonde hair. And Isabella is conveniently not there right now. And so...
Does Duff play both parts?
She does play both parts. She's guessed it.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a real Miley Cyrus, Hannah Montana situation.
So I was totally... I have seen, not this movie, but I had to... I once had to review an entire season of Lizzie McGuire.
Okay.
When I was writing for DVD Verdict. So I've seen a season of Lizzie. I was confusing it with Hannah Montana.
Yeah, I can see how you'd make
I've
that
seen
mistake.
Some Lizzie McGuire. Sure. I never saw the Lizzie McGuire movie.
Okay. Well, I mean, look, if you feel your life would be more complete,
it
go
is
for
the
it.
Anniversary.
Sure.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll see one of the specialty Blu-ray companies put something out. I don't
Vinegar
know.
Vinegar Syndrome.
Yeah. I mean,
it's all over the Lizzie
that
McGuire.
That makes sense.
Movie.
So I wonder if you can guess, since you did watch the TV show.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't remember.
What cast member is in both the Lizzie McGuire movie and a Quentin Tarantino movie called The Hateful Eight?
Interesting. I'm secretly looking at the IMDb right now.
I should point out the person doesn't have a huge role in the movie, but still.
In which movie?
In the Lizzie McGuire movie.
But do they have a huge role in The Hateful
Eight? I mean,
Eight?
Does anyone? Well, it's not Jamie Foxx, I'll tell you that.
He's not in The Hateful Eight.
That's true, he's not.
He's in Django.
But I was right. It's not Jamie Foxx.
No, you're absolutely right.
It's also not a lot of the other people in the movie. A
lot of Italian names. I have no idea. Who is it?
It is Robert Carradine. He plays her dad.
Who is he in The Hateful Eight?
He's in there somewhere because I saw him in the cast list. I swear it.
Maybe his scenes got cut. I remember him playing her dad from the show.
Okay.
But I know him from
Revenge
of
the Nerds. Well, my trivia is failed then because I was like, all right, I'm going to see what movies he's been in that maybe would be weird to talk about. And that was one of them.
Weird.
I've only seen Hateful Eight one time. It was a long time ago. I mean, when it came out.
I watch it like twice a year. I don't know what's wrong with me.
Okay, well, he's in there somewhere. I feel like maybe he's in some of the flashback scenes, possibly.
It's possible.
I could be lying.
I'm not seeing it on his eye. He's in Django.
Maybe I'm thinking of Django.
That's the one with Jamie Foxx.
It is the one
with
Jamie Foxx.
It's the one with the Ewoks.
All right.
Django
it
and
is the one with the Ewoks. I think I might be thinking of Django.
Okay.
They're both...
Apparently, he plays a tracker in Django.
They're both kind of like old-timey
right.
and Tarantino-y
correct.
And revenge-y.
Yeah, they are.
So I'm going to say it's probably Django. Which I'm also
right before making Django Unchained, he made Bikini Spring Break.
Oh, well, I don't know which one has more in common with Lizzie McGuire.
And right before Bikini Spring Break, he made Slumber Party Slaughter.
Well, that sounds like a fun one.
Which comes at the end of a Bikini Spring Break.
Sure.
Yeah, that's how
you... Yeah.
And every...
That was the sneaky sequel to the Lizzie McGuire trip to Rome.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, there you go.
So as somebody who didn't watch Lizzie McGuire...
Yeah.
How do you rate the movie?
I mean, I probably would never have watched it on my own, and I don't probably plan on watching it again, but it was like a fun way to spend a Saturday afternoon. I think it's fine. It's not, it has the same kind of production values that like a Mary Kate and Ashley movie would have had, perhaps.
So good.
I
saw New York Minute in a theater.
Oh, well, there you go.
One of our mutual friends dragged us because she was obsessed with the Olsen twins, dragged us to see New York Minute.
Yeah.
None of which I remember.
Do you remember even a minute of the plot?
They were twins.
Sure.
They were in New York.
Okay.
I think they were both dating different guys.
That makes sense.
I don't think there's like a switch-o-change-o situation going on.
All the best movies, though, do have some sort of switch-o-change-o.
Right?
That seems like a very common trope of the Disney films.
Yes.
I'm not sure why.
Yeah, for sure.
Somebody's really obsessed with the switching. I like it. So the next movie I watched was Megan, as I mentioned.
Ah, yes.
Which, have you seen that one yet?
I said
you did, right?
Yeah.
With Rosie?
Yes.
I thought it was pretty fun.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like the most scary thing I've ever seen, but I don't think it's really trying to be. It's a very like fun, interesting, you know, creepy, meme-worthy movie.
Yeah, it's fun.
And had some good scenes of like creepiness. The doll is super duper creepy. Just the way she moves.
Right.
And the way she stands in the window. Yeah. I don't know. It could have haunted my dreams, but so far it hasn't.
Do you happen to know which version you watched?
We watched the unrated. So I don't know what's different.
I haven't seen the unrated one. So could you tell that this was like unrated?
No. It's R anyway, right?
It's PG-13.
Oh, well, then there's probably more fucks.
Okay.
Because there were a lot of fucks.
Then that must be the big change.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you'd only have one otherwise.
Right. Possibly none.
Possibly none.
Yeah.
But maximum one.
Was it gory at all? Because the
Not really.
The PG-13 is not gory.
Mm-mm.
Okay.
No.
She does pull a kid's ear off.
Yeah, that part
fun.
Was in there.
Yeah, okay.
It was creepy and
yeah,
messed up.
That's pretty funny.
I would say the kid deserved it.
Yeah.
That might make me a monster, but
no,
you know.
I don't think so. It makes you a Megan.
Yeah, that's true. Fair enough. I was watching it with a coworker named Megan, which is partly why we
How
wanted
confusing.
To watch it together. She did not
Did
go
she
crazy.
Keep answering to it every time, like when you accidentally say Alexa in
that
front of your Alexa?
Fun. But no.
No, good.
No.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
I'm going to talk about one more movie, and then I'll talk about a movie we both saw.
Okay.
To just, you know, walk on your parade. So, Under Suspicion. Now, there are two of these. This is not the one with a Hopkins bump. Apparently, there was one with a Hopkins bump, which I have not seen.
Believe me, I've seen it. It's not very good.
Okay. Well, they're unrelated from what I can understand. I don't think one's a remake of the other.
Okay.
This one came out in 91. It's British.
Okay.
And it's directed by Simon Moore. It stars Liam Neeson and Laura Sangiacomo.
Yes.
Have you seen it?
I saw parts of it on cable back in the day, and I think it's like on my Amazon wish list just for the Laura Sangiacomo of it all.
Yeah. She's really sultry in it, as usually she is.
Yes.
Yeah, what happened to her, by the way? Like, I feel like she's not in anything now, but she was, for a minute there, she was kind of an it girl.
Yeah, she was. I mean, she did a lot of, like, she was always kind of a character part, but she was on Just Shoot Me for a while.
Yeah, exactly. That's where I mostly remember her from.
Okay. I'm trying to think of something I just kind of recently saw her in.
Okay.
And it wasn't The Santa Clauses, which I didn't watch. It could have been an episode of Barry, which apparently she was on.
Oh, I should know that because I watched that show, but I don't remember.
What is Violet? Oh, it's the movie Violet that Justine Bateman wrote and directed.
Oh, didn't see it, but
okay.
I'll have to check it out.
Olivia Munn is in it. You might dig it.
I don't know if that's a selling point.
Well,
but
she's good in
I'll
it.
I'll give it a shot.
Yeah.
It's but
worth,
yeah.
Oh, look.
Under Suspicion. So I was interested in this movie primarily because I feel like we don't have a ton of like British erotic thrillers, and that's what this kind of looked like it was going to be, which it sort of is. I would say the chemistry.
Boy, can I take your pants off?
The chemistry
British eroticism.
Is not as great as I would have hoped between Liam Neeson and the women that he gets with.
Is
I just
Liam
don't
Neeson
know
if like inherently like, not that he's unattractive,
no,
but is there like, is there anything sexual about him?
He's not very smoldery.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I feel.
And it's weird because, like, I don't know, like, Harrison Ford is an action guy that also has, like, the the smoldery side.
Yeah.
And I say that just objectively. Like, I don't even really think he's that good looking, but I just, he has that energy.
Yeah.
Liam Neeson doesn't really. No. And in this movie, it was before he was, like, a real big, you know, hero. So he plays almost more of a sad sack in it. Mm. Like, he's a, so he's a policeman who is disgraced because another cop gets shot in the line of duty, basically because of Liam Neeson's action. So they're on a stakeout. Liam Neeson is hooking up with this mobster's wife or mistress or something. And so he goes in the house when they're supposed to be on the stakeout. He misses that the guy comes home. Anyways, that happens. So he leaves the police force disgraced, and then he becomes a private detective.
Okay.
And this is set back in the early 60s, where it was still, like, hard to get a divorce in England. So apparently there was, like, this kind of thing that rose up of, like, having a private detective set up a dirty weekend for you that was, like, you know, you hook up with a woman, but you don't really. He just, like, happens to find you in the hotel and take pictures of you. And then because it's adultery, you can get a quickie divorce. So that's the business he goes into. And his wife is the person that he uses as, like, the woman in each of these scenarios.
Weird.
I know. But they're not, like, actually hooking up. They just have to look like it.
Still weird.
Still weird. Agreed.
Hire somebody.
I agree. So anyway, one of these goes awry, and both his wife and the guy turn up dead in a pretty bloody scene. He is a suspect, but so are a few other people. And it goes on from there.
So he's under suspicion, is what you would say. Okay.
He is.
I got it.
So it's a slow burn in some ways, but it definitely has some interesting kind of twists and turns that I liked. Yeah, I would definitely recommend it. It's, I think, underrated. I don't hear a lot of people talk about it. Okay. So, yeah.
Is it streaming, or was this another half-price
book? It is streaming. I believe I saw it on Amazon Prime.
All right. I'm checking it out right
now.
It
might be on Tubi as well. I'm not sure.
I've been wanting to revisit this movie for a long time because, again, of the Laura San Giacomo.
Sure.
It is on Prime. I will be watching it soon.
There you go. And it's only 99 minutes. So
nice. Finally.
Yeah, I know.
A short movie.
Who would have thought? The last movie I will mention is one that I saw courtesy of you, and that is Wild Things.
Yeah, baby.
In the theater.
Yeah.
And with the director. So, maybe I should let you talk about this first.
No, it was a thing that we booked, like, this. So I host this series called Smash Cut Cinema once a month, and the man that I book it with is a guy named Mike, and he had suggested Wild Things because it was going to be the 25th anniversary, and he said, McNaughton's a Chicago guy. I wonder if we could get him. And we were both like, eh, probably not. So we booked it anyway. And then, like, a week before the screening, he showed up in my on my Facebook page as someone you may know. So I just clicked on his profile and messaged him and said, hey, we're doing a 25th anniversary screening of Wild Things. Would you be interested? And he wrote back, like, the next day, like, yeah, sure.
That's so cool.
Yeah. So he came out and did a Q&A at the beginning. I was incredibly nervous.
It didn't show.
Well, that's nice of you to say. I hadn't seen the movie in a long-ass time. So it was really fun to revisit it with it pretty fresh because I'm not overly familiar with it. What was your reaction to McNaughton or to the movie?
Well, McNaughton, I thought, was a delight. He is from Chicago, and he's from the south side of Chicago specifically, which I think is important to mention because he has that energy, right? He talked about how he never met a rich person until he went to college. And I really think that helps sort of set the movie because it is a little bit about, you know, the class divide and the privilege of some people. And I enjoyed that. He told some fun anecdotes, and especially, you know, I think anybody that works with Bill Murray has a Bill Murray story. I enjoyed his Bill Murray story of how he coaxed him to do that last pickup scene in the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And just seeing the movie again. So I saw it, I don't know, it's probably like 2005 or something like that. And I probably have only seen it one other time since then. So I remembered loving it. I didn't remember every single thing that happened, which was kind of the delight of, like, going back to it because it's so twisty and so fun.
Right.
And it aged super well. Like, I wasn't sure if it was going to.
Yeah.
And I think it did because it is so not what you think it's going to be in a way. Like, there's certain ways you could have played it where it would be troubling. Didn't think it was. Okay. I thought it really held up well. And it's just a really fun, like, twisty, swampy, noir kind of movie.
Yeah, it's like trash. It's like good.
Yeah, but
it's
like
good
in a good
trash.
Way. Well-written trash.
Yes.
Right?
Well directed, well acted. The cast
it looks
is like
gorgeous.
Aces. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's weird to me how little it ever occurred to me that, like, oh, these are supposed to be high school students.
Right.
And I think it's because they're both clearly pushing 30.
Yes.
And so there's never that question in your mind of just like, this is so inappropriate. You just kind of go along with it. But yeah, watching it the other night, I was like, oh, right. They're in high school.
Yeah.
This is so weird. Whatever. It's really fun. And he was very cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Was there anything that he said during the Q&A that kind of helped frame it differently for you or that you took away from it?
I mean, not necessarily. The way he described that opening sequence about, like, starting in the swamp and then going further and further up and the evolution of wealth and man, I was just like, oh, this is definitely, like, an art house filmmaker making trash. Like,
right.
He's putting this thought into it that I never did, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it bumps me out because I one of my recurring questions or something that I keep repeating is like there is no modern equivalent of Teresa Russell.
Yeah.
And she shows up in this movie and her and Ellen Barkin and some other actresses that we've talked about before. Like there's no modern equivalent for any of these people. I don't think there's a modern, even though she still works, like Denise Richards still continues to work. I don't think there's a modern equivalent of even Denise Richards.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. It would be like a either singer or reality star that's trying to make the crossover
right.
that would appear in a movie like that now. And
whereas Denise Richards went from movie star to reality TV star.
Well, yeah, so. It was she went a different direction with that, right? But yeah, I mean, I think in the early days we kind of took people like her for granted.
Yeah.
Because she tended to play a certain type of character,
right.
But she does it very well.
Yeah.
And I think she also has at least some self-awareness about it because even look at like Drop Dead Gorgeous, right? She's clearly
she's so
playing a
that.
Very tongue-in-cheek version of her character there. So I think she's more aware than people gave her credit for at the time.
I would agree with that. Yeah. Anyway, that was fun. The next Smash Cuts screening is RoboCop
That's
in April.
Be so fun.
And I've never seen RoboCop theatrically. So one of the things that I often take into consideration when I program these movies is stuff that I've never seen on the big screen that I want to see on the big screen. So RoboCop is definitely one. And we're showing the director's cut. So
yeah.
I'm even
That's
more excited.
So
yeah.
Awesome.
I took Charlie to see Shazam Fury of the Gods.
Ooh.
Whatever.
Uh-huh.
It's fine. Like, I won't say I disliked it, even though I didn't particularly like it.
Mm-hmm.
It is incredibly overstuffed. There are way too many characters, way too many storylines. Other, you know, past DC characters show up. And as soon as they do, you're like, but none of this matters because they're rebooting the whole thing. Which may speak to the film's, like, disappointing box office that people are just like, why would I bother? I know they're relaunching.
Right.
There are at least attempts at, like, character arcs and themes. Probably too many. Like, everybody has an arc and everybody gets a theme. And it's like, one or two would probably be good,
yeah,
guys.
Yeah.
But coming off of something like Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania, which I don't think attempted any of that stuff. I'll take it. At least it's trying to be a movie. I didn't love it, but at least it's trying to be a movie.
Yeah. Did you like the first Shazam?
I thought the first. Yeah, I thought it was like a pleasant surprise.
Okay.
And I think that's part of the problem with this movie, too, is that it no longer has the element of surprise. There's an expectation going into it, and it has to live up to that expectation, and I don't think it does. But the first one was like, that was better than it should have been.
Mm-hmm.
And this new one is like, that wasn't as good as it could be. So, whatever. Shazam, Fury of the Gods. I watched two movies based on last week's podcast. I think Adam and I talked about two different movies that I sought out. The first is Return to Paradise, which we talked about with Vince Vaughn and Joaquin Phoenix and Anne Heche, which is about Vince Vaughn and Joaquin and a third actor whose name I don't know get into some trouble. I don't even totally want to describe the plot because I didn't know the plot. Vince Vaughn has to make the decision whether or not to go back to, I think it's Thailand or the Philippines. Hmm. Anyway, and serve a prison sentence okay. for something that happened years ago. And if he doesn't, they're going to execute Joaquin Phoenix, basically. So it becomes this moral dilemma of, do I let this guy die and continue to live my life, or do I do the right thing and go serve?
Yeah.
Vince Vaughn is really good in it, and Hayes is really good in it. Joaquin Phoenix is not in it that much, mm-hmm. which I'm okay with. And even though I like him in the right movie, I'm not dissing Joaquin, anybody. It's really good.
I've never heard of it before you mentioned it, I think, on the last week's
yeah.
podcast.
So. I think it came out in like 97, maybe?
The Vince Vaughn Joaquin movie that I was familiar with from that era, of course, is Clay Pigeons.
Clay Pigeons, yes, yeah, baby.
Which is a great movie.
I like that movie. It's got Janine.
Yeah, it does.
somebody, not Indicator, Imprint.
Okay.
Just put out Return to Paradise on Blu-ray.
Nice.
But you'd have to import it, and sure. it's a little pricey. I got it from the library.
Libraries exist.
Yeah, exactly. That was that's probably the way to see it, because I don't know how much replay value it honestly has. And then the other one I watched was Shattered Glass, which I had never seen.
Yeah, good movie, if I remember correctly.
Such a good movie. JB has been talking it up for years. Adam mentioned it last week. Mm-hmm. I looked it up and saw that it was streaming on Tubi, so there was no reason not to see it. Great Hayden Christensen performance.
Yeah, really good.
Amazing cast. I mean, everybody in the movie is like, there's Chloe Sevigny, there's Melanie Lynskey, there's mm-hmm. Steve Zahn, there's Rosario Dawson, there's Peter Sarsgaard. You know, everybody is like somebody you're happy to see show up in a movie.
Yeah.
Super good. And again, like 90 minutes.
Yeah.
And the last one I'll talk about is a movie that I was happy to see show up on Tubi. Because I've been trying to see it for years, and the DVD is out of print, and I have not been able to see it. But that is from 1991, a Nicolas Cage movie that I had never seen, called Zondali. It's not even an erotic thriller. It's like a pseudo-erotic love story. It's just, you know, a romantic drama with a lot of fucking in it, basically.
Yeah. Nothing wrong with that.
Erica Anderson, I think is her name. She plays Greta in Nightmare on Elm Street 5. She plays the lead. It takes place in New Orleans. Her name is Zondali. Mm-hmm. She's married to Judge Reinhold. Everyone's doing Cajun accents.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. And Nicolas Cage shows up as the brooding, like, brother.
Sure.
And they start a torrid affair. And then things go bad. And it's amazing. It's not good,
sure.
but like the Nicolas Cage performance is something else. I want to search up the best quote of the movie. Shoot.
I feel like every movie is elevated just by being set in New Orleans because it just adds a certain milieu to the film.
Yeah.
I don't know about the accents part. I can't.
Yeah, this one's
Judge
a little
Reinhold
tricky.
Doing any kind of accents.
I cannot believe they don't have it. I can't believe they don't have this quote as part of the most memorable IMDb quotes. So now I can't
do
it.
Now you're going to have to add the quote yourself.
I probably should because I can't do it justice. Anyway.
Well, I know what I'm watching on Tubi next.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not, again, not good, but should it be seen by Nicolas Cage aficionados? Yes, absolutely. If Vinegar Syndrome put it out on Blu-ray, would I buy it? Yes, absolutely, I would. Enough about Zondali. Let's talk about The Village.
Let's talk about The Village.
Comes out in 2004, M. Night, riding high, Sixth Sense, boom, enormous hit. Unbreakable, boom, enormous hit. Signs, boom, enormous hit. The Village, wait a second.
Yeah.
I saw this on my honeymoon with Erica.
Aw.
Yeah, we were married in 2004. We were in Orlando. And we went to like the movie theater at Disney Springs. First, we ate at, I think, a Planet Hollywood.
As one does.
And then we went to like the Disney Springs theater and saw The Village. And I was a little mixed on it. Mm-hmm. I have been mixed on it for years. This most recent viewing was the best it's ever played for me. And I think part of that has to do with knowing what to expect.
Mm-hmm.
I still believe that there's maybe a twist that's unnecessary, but it is necessary because it's kind of what the movie's about. We'll talk about all that.
Yeah.
We will be spoiling The Village. If you've never seen The Village, I think we both recommend it.
We do.
Okay. I know you're a huge
Strongly.
Fan. Yeah. But we have to spoil it to talk about it.
We
so
do.
You should turn this off if you've never seen it. The thing I tweeted out over the weekend was that I would put this in my top five Shyamalan. And a lot of people chimed in. Some people said this would be my number one. Other people said, hell yeah, it is. Is this your favorite Shyamalan?
This is my favorite Shyamalan.
That's what I thought.
By far.
Okay.
And I love many of his other movies.
Yeah.
I can't stand by like The Lady in the Water.
Mm.
I mean, I haven't seen it in a while, to be fair, but I wasn't like blown away.
No.
And I haven't seen After Earth, and I haven't seen Avatar, The Last Airbender.
Oof.
I've heard bad things enough that I don't know if I want to see them. I mean, maybe at some point to be a completist. But I love The Happening, right? I am a Happening defender.
Wow.
I even stand by the Mark Wahlberg of it all. Like,
really?
It brings me so much joy.
Well,
and happiness.
That I can't argue with.
I love the things he writes. Devil is a movie that I feel is extremely underrated.
Yeah, I would
agree
with that.
I haven't watched The Servant yet, but
I haven't either.
I am curious about it. So
yeah.
I just think he has a really interesting kind of point of view as both a director and a storyteller. And sometimes those sensibilities line up really well.
Mm-hmm.
And other times I feel like he maybe isn't getting across what he had in his mind. But I think The Village is one of the most like perfectly realized visions of a director where he had a story in mind. He told the story he wanted to tell with the people he wanted to tell, with the craftspeople he wanted. I mean, he gets Roger frickin' Deakins.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
To be his DP on this movie. It's just, and I think, unfortunately, and this has probably been said many times before, but the marketing really did not help this movie. Because
okay.
It was marketed as a horror movie, and it's not a horror movie. You know, it's, if anything, it's a romance. Which
sure.
I realized much more on this viewing than I had in any previous viewing. It's a love story that happens to have some like thrillery elements
mm-hmm.
to it, but it's mostly a drama.
It's hard for me at times, as especially in 2004, the thing that I loved about those first three Shyamalans
mm-hmm.
were that he would take a sort of fantastic premise and then say, okay, but what if that was really happening? So what if there really were ghosts? What would that
mm-hmm.
look like? What if there really were superheroes? What would that look like? What if aliens really landed? What would that look like?
Yeah.
And The Happening, he kind of gets away from that. So I think you're right in terms of the marketing, because I went in expecting, okay, what if there were monsters that lived in the woods and we had
right.
to stay where we are or else they'll get us. And there is a part of me that when I watch it that – it's so effective. I really like the monster design.
Yeah.
There's part of me that still wishes like that was the story he was telling.
Right.
And I do have to actively divorce myself from like wishing it was something else and accept it for what it is. And I think the reason that it played best for me this time is because I was most able to like accept it for what it is this time.
Yeah. It's funny because I was reading interviews and watching interviews with Shyamalan and the cast from that time period, and they do actively avoid spoiling it. But then in interviews that you read with him now, where he's looking back on it, he's even said, I don't believe there is a twist, which I don't know if I'd go that far.
Right.
But his mind was, he wasn't trying to tell that kind of story. He was trying to tell a story about that was kind of a fairy tale, like kind of in his mind, he started as this is a riff on Little Red Riding Hood.
Okay.
Which I think is kind of cool.
Yeah.
And it almost inverts the other movies he did, which was what you just said.
Right.
Like, what
right,
if
right.
this crazy thing were real?
Right.
This is what if everybody believed this thing were real, but it isn't real.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really interesting way to approach storytelling when he could have probably easily repeated himself.
100%. Yeah.
So I think it was brave on his part to do, and it was a failure in some ways, but in other ways, like, it still all came together. It's just people didn't necessarily receive it the way he wanted them.
Yeah, why do you suppose it was so, like, widely rejected at the time? Was it just because people were expecting something else than what they got?
I think so. I think it was just... It had slightly different pacing, right? And all of his movies are really deliberate in their pace, especially back then. Like, I just rewatched Sixth Sense, too. And it's a slow movie, right? It takes a long time to get to even what Cole's secret is.
Yes.
But you're getting little hints of interesting things along the way. Whereas this movie, you kind of start out with the most, quote-unquote, exciting part of, like, there's monsters in the woods and... You see the boys playing their game where they're like daring each other to stand with their back to the woods, and you hear the noises and you see the little kind of like glimpses of red. And so I think it gives more of that stuff up front.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you finally get to the reveal of, you know, what is really going on, it does feel a little bit like you're having the rug pulled out from under you. But I feel that is intentional because that character is having the rug pulled out from under her.
Right.
So people are rejecting it, but I think they're rejecting it in the same way that people in that town would have rejected, like, or in that, you know, village, would have rejected the notion that this is a lie that has been perpetuated for, quote unquote, their protection.
So I was surprised again on this rewatch, and this was probably the third or fourth time I've seen it, that first reveal is pretty... Not early in the movie, but it's maybe two-thirds.
Sure.
My memory it was that it was a twist that happened near the end.
Yeah.
And it's not, really. It's before Ivy goes on her journey, William Hurt reveals to her in his William Hurt way, it is farce.
Yes.
And that's not a line that I love. And it's partly on his delivery.
Yeah.
I was looking for quotes. Because a lot of times for the episode description, I just take a quote from the movie and plug our names into it. And I was looking for quotes, and I was looking at, like, the dialogue in this movie is bizarre. But it doesn't feel as bizarre to me in the moment. When I'm watching it, I don't feel like, with the exception of a few lines like, it is farce.
Yeah.
Or like, Papa, I can't see his color. Like, some of that stuff stands out to me. But like... When I watch something like The Happening, no offense to The Happening, or Old, like, that dialogue is fucking insane.
Yeah.
And you can tell in the moment that, like, what they're saying is impossible to say.
Right. Human beings do not speak that way.
Right. And as written, that's how the village was feeling to me. But when I watch the movie, the actors, like, really sell those lines.
I think it's because of the caliber of actor he got, too. It's, I mean,
nuts.
He cast Bryce Dallas Howard because he saw her in a play.
Right.
She hadn't done any, I don't think she'd done any movies up to that point.
Is her first movie,
I think,
really?
It might be. If not, it would have been like minor stuff, probably. Obviously, Joaquin Phoenix, you know, love him or hate him, definitely has an ability to deliver pretty much any kind of dialogue or not dialogue. And actually, he had told M. Night Shyamalan on Signs that he was kind of like wishing that he could get a role where he didn't have to speak because he's kind of tired of talking. And then he was given this role where he basically only talks like a very small amount. So that was interesting. And then, you know, obviously like William Hurt and Sigourney Weaver and, you know, Brendan Gleeson, like all these actors are very, very skilled at their craft and have probably done, you know, I don't know if they've all done Shakespeare, but I'm sure they've done some like period acting. So I think they help sell it in a way. And if it feels mannered, there is a reason for that also, which, you know,
absolutely,
the reveal explains.
So she had some like, she was like an extra in a couple things. Ron Howard movies. She pops up and stuff. And then this same year, she's in a movie called Book of Love, which I've actually seen because it's another movie that I reviewed that's not great. And I think she has a pretty small part in it, but it's 2004, the same year she does The Village.
Okay.
So this, for all intents and purposes, is her first
It's the first
movie.
Lead for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, right.
Which is pretty incredible because I feel
so
like her
good.
Performance is bananas good.
I love her in this movie. I'm a huge fan of her just in anything, but like, yeah, especially in this movie, I really, really like her performance.
Yeah. And I don't know if I've personally seen her equal this in any other movie. I mean, she's been great in a lot of things.
Yeah.
But I feel like this really plays to her strengths.
Yes.
Of she does have like a gentleness and a wit to her delivery and things. And this really like allows her to play with that stuff more.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think she's phenomenal.
Let's talk about the elephant in the room named Adrien Brody.
Yeah.
What are your feelings on the Adrien Brody performance and the Noah character?
I'm sure that's probably the most controversial part of this movie.
Yeah.
It doesn't bother me because I feel like he's not playing it exactly to the like stereotypical this kind of character.
Okay.
He's
not going full Simple Jack?
Correct.
Got it. Okay.
And there are maybe people that would argue with me on that, but I feel like he brings it to life. He actually like has some really fun, kind of adorable, endearing scenes early on with Ivy, you know, where they're kind of like running around and playing games and having secrets. And he gets to say some like fun lines, right? It's not just him like not being, I don't know. I feel like he's not one dimensional.
Sure.
I'm not entirely like sure how I feel about him being the villain, but right. I also do right. understand why that choice is made for the purposes of the story. And I think it also complicates how you feel about the elders in this movie because of how they handle that situation and how they handle him generally.
Mm-hmm.
Like we see the quiet room or the quiet house that he has to like get locked in. And that's like appalling, right? That they would do that to a person.
Right.
Especially when you find out that, you know, they have a lot more knowledge than people in 1897 had.
Right.
So I do think it's more an indictment on them than it is on him. And I know Adrien Brody has talked about how he like spent time with people that had different learning disabilities and things like that. And it was important to him not to play it as just a one note character.
Sure.
But I can see this being a barrier for some people.
Well, if it wasn't, I feel like I would have less of an issue with it if it wasn't part of a larger thesis that like M. Night seems to be working out, which is like anyone with mental disabilities or mental illness is somehow, I don't want to say less than, but I mean, you think about like the elderly couple in The Visit.
Sure.
You think about Noah in this, you think about James McAvoy in Split, you think about he demonizes these characters a little bit.
That's true. That's fair.
And it's if this was an isolated incident, I would be like, okay, this makes sense for the story that he's telling, but because it keeps popping up throughout his work, it's like, what grudge does this guy have against people with mental illness or mental disabilities? I do not believe that he actually has a grudge.
Right.
I really do not.
It maybe is a trope he's falling onto a little too often.
And maybe that's what it is.
Yeah.
Again, is it a deal breaker? No. Again, I don't want to rewrite the movie as I'm watching it, but as I was watching it this past weekend, I was like, part of me was wishing that the reveal about the fact that they are in fact disguising themselves as the creatures would come when they discover that Noah has gotten into the floorboards.
Yeah.
Instead of having William Hurt reveal it and explaining it all in kind of slightly clunky dialogue to Bryce Dallas Howard, like wait until we get to that moment and they're like, oh, he found the suits in the floor. And then we figure it out. Oh my gosh, it's them pretending. Again, is it a deal breaker? No, it's just me wishing for things to be a little bit different. But so then there's a second twist, quote unquote twist, that it is not, in fact, 1897. It is, in fact, modern day. Does that make the movie better for you?
For me, yes.
Okay.
So for me, I have a very, and I think I mentioned this last time, right? I have a very, like, unique personal connection to that part of it, which is the way that I was raised.
Mm-hmm.
And I see a lot of parallels. I was not raised to think that there were monsters in the woods or anything.
Why not?
That I don't know. But in some ways, in a symbolic way, I guess, I kind of was.
Yeah.
Because I was raised, like, I was homeschooled for the specific explicit purpose of, like, not learning certain things about the world. I was very sheltered. Mm-hmm. When I was 12, we moved to a place that was like listed as a cult by the church my parents went to. And we were there until I was 18. And it was like...
The church listed it a cult?
The church that we went to before.
Okay.
Because it was like an offshoot of this church.
Okay.
And they like listed it as a cult. And my parents moved there.
Okay.
And it was like everybody lived on the same campus together. We ate together. We, you know, there were lots of rules. You couldn't date unless like the people in charge approved of it. And you had to be out of college. All the women had to wear dresses all the time. You know, all this stuff. And they constantly would preach this one like verse from the Bible that talks about how we're in the world, but not of the world. And I feel like that like theory kind of resonates with the people in this movie. Like they're trying so hard to protect themselves and their kids from the world, so to speak, but they realize that they bring it with them wherever they go. Right.
Right?
There's no really way to escape what, you know, heartbreaks and what emotions are out there. And so any attempt to create either a utopian society or a religious society that is so closed off ends up breeding more problems.
Mm-hmm.
And a movie that I thought addressed that really well this past year was Women Talking, which I don't know if you saw.
I did, yeah.
But, you know, that's also based on a true story, and it's about another, like, closed community that all these problems ended up happening,
Mennonites,
right? Yeah, Mennonites.
Okay.
Which, ironically, my parents were very interested in, like, the Amish and Mennonite lifestyle when I was a kid and thought that that would be, like, really cool to do of, like, living off the grid. And so I know a lot of people that kind of think this way.
Okay.
And I think it does come from a generally good place of like they want the best for their families and they want to live a simple life. And farming seems really romantic until you do it. You know what I mean? So all of that to say, like, I think this idea of people trying to like live outside of reality is relatable. There are groups of people that do this. And for me, it was like super real. Yeah, I like that they put that in there because I think it's important to the thesis of the movie, which is like you kind of can't outrun feelings. And that's what some of them are trying to do. Mm-hmm. And some of them are also just trying to outrun like, you know, crime. But crime crops up because it's human nature. Right. And so any attempt to like get away from it, you're really just kind of waiting for it to happen.
I have to say, if I knew Bryce Dallas Howard and then somebody I knew started dating her, I would also stab him.
That so, is completely fair.
Crime will follow us,
sure.
Is what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Adrian Brody was justified in what he did. He's the hero of this movie, I think is what I'm trying to
say.
Yeah,
no, totally.
So this is the part that I'm still trying to reconcile. This is that was actually the most I've heard you kind of talk about your upbringing. How do you like... reconcile that with like how you've chosen to live now? Like, is your family cool with it or
some
if it's
of
too
them,
personal to
no,
talk
it's
about
cool.
by the way just
I brought
shut
it up. No, it's cool. So to varying degrees. So I actually left the like compound or whatever when I turned 18, and like the president of the compound kind of like brought me in his office and like gave me a letter that was like, you know, by leaving you're like consenting to like, you know, jeopardize your salvation and all this stuff.
Do you still have the letter?
I don't.
Okay,
I wish
good.
I did. That would have been cool.
We could make it a Patreon exclusive.
Yeah. My parents were there for about a year after that, and then they left too.
Oh, they did. Good.
And I think, you know, maybe they would have anyways, partly because they were running out of money because this place didn't pay much. But yeah, it's interesting. Like my family has all kind of gone different directions in terms of like how strict they still are. Some of them are more strict than others. My mom for a very long time still like didn't want me to, you know, go to concerts or watch movies or any of that stuff. So I kind of went the very opposite direction with that because I wasn't allowed to see or experience pop culture. And so then as soon as I turned 18, I was like, give me all the pop culture.
Right.
And
what was the first movie that you saw? We talked about it, didn't
Never
we?
Been Kissed.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's what I thought. Okay.
That's the one.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean... she's come around. Like she now like will go watch Disney movies with us in the theater and stuff like that. But she's still pretty religious. My dad is still pretty religious. My sisters are all kind of like varying degrees, but we're all pretty chill. Definitely compared to those standards. So, but I still do talk to some people that are still in that life.
Okay.
And they're still like very devout and very into it. And I'm like, well, I guess if it makes you happy, sure. But I was never like happy in that situation.
Right.
And I still even like have dreams where I'm there and I'm like trying to run away. So I know it's like somewhere in there.
Right.
But it's.
Wow.
Yeah. Like it's interesting. Right. Because I also feel like if I hadn't had that experience, would pop culture mean as much to me as it does?
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, because that was kind of like my first connection to like the outside world was like sneakily listening to the radio.
Okay.
So I don't know. I feel like, yeah, I wonder if this story were to continue in the village, if Ivy would potentially want to go back and explore more, if other people from the village would ever be curious. Because right. I think that's one thing that I didn't. Well, I mean, obviously, they built in this mechanism to scare people from going outside. And there's lots of scare tactics when it comes to, you know, cults and religion and whatever. But I don't know. I feel like there would still be somebody that would be curious and that would venture.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Does Ivy just go back to like towing the line and telling everyone that the monsters are real?
Right. Because she knows the truth.
Right.
But then she thinks she killed one.
True.
So.
That is true.
I don't know.
I don't either. And she doesn't necessarily get an understanding of like what year it actually is on the outside, right?
Right? Because I mean, she can't see, so
right.
she doesn't see the car. She heard the noise.
Right.
But she doesn't really know. And that's probably why they decided it was okay to send her.
Yeah.
Because she wouldn't be able to see.
Right. So that's the part that I'm still trying to reconcile is like not looking at it as a twist and looking at it as like this is the story that's being told. It's this group of people. The extent to which they will go to try to stave off grief.
Mm-hmm.
And trauma, and the extent to which they will hide from the world, you know,
right.
Exactly like what you were saying. And it was really only on this most recent viewing that I was like, oh, I need to afford this movie the opportunity to like present itself through that lens rather than just seeing it as a twist at the end, mm-hmm. because M. Night felt like he needed to have a twist, you know. And again, this movie has more or less two twists.
Yeah.
But I think that we need to maybe reframe using that word twist in this instance and just call them reveals.
Yeah, it's like a story development more
right.
so than a twist,
right.
I would say. And I mean, for all the haters out there that like...
of which there are many.
There are
and
many.
That's fine.
Still,
it's totally
and that's
fine
okay.
to hate this movie.
But there are a lot of people who for a long time were like, oh, M. Night Shyamalan, he has to do a twist in everything. And...
right.
So did Rod Serling. We don't hate him. You know what I mean?
No, like, people love the Twilight Zone.
Yeah. I'm not saying they're on the same level necessarily, but I think that same like genealogy is there mm-hmm. of it's fine if that's your formula or your pattern. But
right.
I do think he goes beyond that. Right. I do think he's at least now we all kind of have seen more of his work. So we aren't just waiting for that twist moment to happen.
Mm-hmm.
This movie was unfortunately set up for everybody to just be like, all right, what is it going to be? What is it going to be?
Right,
and then
exactly.
Your imagination might be something way more elaborate than what it actually was.
But what is the twist in Signs? Is there a twist in Signs?
Well, I guess that...
is it like they
that
are
Mel
allergic
Gibson's,
to water?
No, it's that like Mel Gibson's wife like saw it coming in the accident because she says to
right,
like tell him
away.
To swing away.
Right.
Signs
rules. Can I just say
I
that?
No. Okay, I wanted to squeeze that one in before I came over here too, but I didn't have time, but I love that.
M. Night was on fire for a while, man.
Yeah.
So is this the movie? I do think even when I was like less a fan of this movie,
mm-hmm.
I did always believe it's like one of his best made movies.
Yeah.
With the exception of like that bad post-production slow-mo he does when Adrian Brody as the monster is charging her
mm-hmm.
and he tries to slow it down
yeah.
before she moves out of the way. It's like, you don't need to do that. Just play this
no.
out in real time. But yeah, you mentioned the Roger Deakins photography, the James Newton Howard score, the performances,
oh my God,
the cast,
that score.
The production design. I mean, everything about this movie is like impeccable.
Yeah.
If you don't like the writing, you don't like the writing, and I get it. But I won't say the failure of this movie because
mm-hmm.
it wasn't a failure, but it was considered a disappointment because
yes.
audiences kind of rejected it for the first time. Is this what leads to the start of the sort of flop sweat spiral, or is that Lady in the Water?
I think Lady in the Water is really where it all started to super fall apart. Because I think with this one, at least that first weekend, you still got an audience, right?
Yeah.
With Lady in the Water, some people had already kind of fallen off. And then they saw that movie and were probably scratching their heads like, wait, what?
Did you ever read The Man Who Heard Voices?
I did not.
It's like a book-length apology for Lady in the Water.
Wow. Okay.
It reads one of two ways. Like, I read it right before seeing Lady in the Water. If you read the book and you love Lady in the Water, the book reads like, look at this misunderstood genius who did what no one else believed he could do. And if you don't like Lady in the Water, the book is like, well, it's because they wouldn't let me make the movie I wanted to make.
Sure.
So,
I think for me it doesn't work because I'm not crazy about Paul Giamatti.
I kind of like Paul Giamatti. I have never – it's like – it's – you know the guy in The Happening that like keeps talking about hot dogs?
Yeah.
Everyone who lives in the apartment building in Lady in the Water is the hot dog guy.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's part of it. Like, I'm working out half my body and I like all that. It's like too much quirk.
Yeah.
The Paul Giamatti character is fine. He's basically Mel Gibson from Signs, right? Yeah, he's like
true.
Living through this past trauma. Bryce Dallas Howard not given a chance to give a great performance because she's a symbol. She's not even a character.
Yeah.
All the bad stuff about the critic. There's a lot about that movie that frustrates me.
Mm-hmm.
I want to like it, especially these last few years when I've really done not a turnaround on Shyamalan, but I've just learned something about myself, which is how much I like his movies.
Yes.
But I'm not there on Lady in the Water yet.
I feel like if I revisited it, I might appreciate it more.
Okay.
But I also am at peace with not loving every single thing that he does.
Yeah, I'm never going to love After Earth or Last Airbender or The Happening.
And you saw Knock at the Cabin, right?
Yes.
Did you like that one or no?
I would probably put that at number 5.
Oh. Okay, so you liked it.
Yes, I liked it quite a bit.
I was not as big of a fan, but I do think it had a lot of interesting things going on.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like he's on his upswing now, which is great, which kind of started with The Visit and then, you know, obviously Split and everything. So it's good to see him kind of back. But I don't know that he'll ever get the kind of budget or the kind of latitude that he had on The Village.
Right.
Where he was, okay, he's coming off of 3 gigantic hits.
Right.
You know? I don't know that he will ever get to that point. He still makes money, but I don't know that the studios even are in a position to, like, give him that kind of money anymore.
I think what he's doing now as a means of retaining, like, total control.
Right.
Is he self-finances everything.
Yeah.
I think even Knock at the Cabin was like a $20 million that he self-financed, which is insane until you remember that like George Lucas self-financed The Phantom Menace. But self-financing a $20 million movie is still
pretty insane. Yeah, exactly.
Especially one that, you know, will recoup its budget, but not by much. It was like number one the weekend it came out with like $14 million and then dropped off to like 4 or 5 after that.
Yeah.
Which surprised me because I think Knock at the Cabin and The Village actually share a lot in common.
They do.
In terms of some of the thematic stuff.
Some ethical questions of like the many versus the few, you know.
And I don't want to spoil anything about Knock at the Cabin, but like The Village has a reveal more than a twist.
Agreed.
Yeah.
It ended up being more straightforward than I was expecting.
Okay.
Which is not why I had an issue with it. I had other issues with it. But yeah, I did like it, but I didn't like it as much as I wanted to.
Okay.
But, you know, kind of going back to The Village, I think one of the things that works really well in it is the atmosphere.
Yes.
And I don't, that's another thing where I'm like, I don't know if he has ever had a movie since then where he had that sustained of an atmosphere. And I don't know if it's because of the people he was working with or the fact that they were on a location that was completely built from scratch and they were able to control a lot of it. I do think, obviously, Deakins brought a lot to it.
Yeah.
I think the fact that he had them all live in a 1897-style village and learn all those skills for, like, a week and, like, did a boot camp of living like colonial people. Like,
does it make for a better movie?
I don't don't know, but I think it's cool. Like, I don't know.
I guess, unless they ask me to do it. And I'm like, no, I just want to show up and say the words that you wrote. Like, sure. Why do I have to learn how to churn butter?
I don't know. It's a fun thing the actors can talk about in interviews.
I guess.
I just think that atmosphere is something he used to be really, really good at. And I'm not entirely sure if he still has that.
Okay. I could see that. He's doing more like, I mean, Knock at the Cabin, I think, is a little bit of a departure. I think it's the closest he's come to, like, phase one.
Mm-hmm.
If we're saying phase one is Sixth Sense to The Village.
Yeah.
I think Knock at the Cabin is closest he's gotten to the kind of glory days. But he seems to be more interested in, like, high concept, low budget.
Right.
Leaning into that sort of Twilight Zone mm-hmm. thing, movies like Old, you know, where it's like, I have this idea about a beach that makes you grow old. Okay, yeah. And go with it.
Right.
I don't know if he wants to get back to the kind of like stateliness of something like The Village.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, if it's working for him, why change it, I guess? But
yeah.
It's fun to see what he was capable of doing with those resources, because a lot of people who start small fumble when they get to that level.
Absolutely.
And I don't think he did fumble. I think he directed the shit out of this movie.
He grows, I think, with every movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then here's kind of where we're at the top of the roller coaster hill, whatever you want to call it, before the drop. And Lady in the Water represents kind of the drop. But this, I think, is the peak. And I'm not saying it's his best movie, but in terms of his craft and the people he's got working around him, mm-hmm. I think this is absolutely the peak.
Yeah. I mean, even just talking about the score, I don't think there's any other Shyamalan movie where I could readily recall what the score sounds like outside of the movie. But the score to this with the Hilary Hahn violin solos and everything is just absolutely astounding. Like, it's so, so good.
Yeah, it makes me a little sad that the movie was rejected because I'm curious where he would have climbed to next as opposed to falling off.
Right. That being said, I'm going to be a little bit of a contrarian and say I think it actually is good that somebody with his kind of creativity had a couple failures.
Okay.
And the reason I say that is because sometimes you need someone to like check your genius a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
And you do see some filmmakers who have gotten carte blanche and it doesn't always turn out great because I feel like they feel like they can do whatever they want. They do. And it's not for everybody else. It's for them.
Okay.
So I do think it's kind of good that he got down like a couple pegs only because that's forced him to kind of retreat back into his own creativity and kind of come up with something different and a different approach. And if he had started repeating himself, maybe we wouldn't still be talking about him 20 years later.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's true. Reading. I mean, I encourage you to read The Man Who Heard Voices.
Yeah.
Because it will completely underline exactly what you just said, which is like, this is a guy who needs to come back down to earth a little bit.
Right.
Although a big thrust of the book is that he was leaving Disney because they dared to give him some notes on Lady in the Water. And he leaves Disney and he goes to Warner Brothers. And then, you know, has that experience, the Lady in the Water experience at Warner Brothers. But now has just left Universal to go back to Warner Brothers. So he's back where he made Lady in the Water.
Interesting.
Yeah. I don't know.
I'm curious to see what he does next. I mean, I probably will almost always show up to an opening weekend of his unless it's Avatar: The Last Airbender.
I have, with the exception of that run. I didn't see Last Airbender in theaters, and I didn't see After Earth in theaters. I have seen both since.
Okay.
But I think that's it. Otherwise, I've been there like opening weekend for every movie he's done, I think. I think. I'm looking him up right now to see what he has next, because he's pretty good about like announcing his next project. Let me ask you about William Hurt and Sigourney Weaver.
Yeah.
I really like their relationship, this sort of unspoken thing. I like the scene a lot where he says, it's all I have to give you.
Mm-hmm.
This idea that he sort of loves her from afar. She loves him. They cannot be together. Where does that fit in with the larger story to you?
I feel like we see their relationship as like the earlier generation's version of Lucius and Ivy, where Ivy is going to take that initiative and cross that bridge that Lucius isn't quite as comfortable with. So that's when they have that conversation on the porch and, you know, she basically lays it all out there. And then he gives his best speech in the movie, which is short but wonderfully sweet. And he talks about how, you know, why do you have to say everything that's in your head when you know, I feel like I have to hold back and all that stuff that he says, which is really nice. But I do think it's just kind of an echo of that earlier generation.
Okay.
And how there are going to be some maybe differences in how the younger generation approaches things like love and romance, whereas obviously the older generation is so closed off because they're all there because of a trauma, because they've lost someone, because of something horrible that has happened. And so it's almost like they can't get to that super vulnerable place because it's too painful. Mm-hmm. But hopefully the younger generation isn't as afraid of those feelings.
I love that. Nice. According to IMDb, his next movie is called Trap, and it comes out in 2024.
All right.
But it also says there's an untitled M. Night Shyamalan project also coming out in 2024. And then something called Labor of Love that has no release information.
Hmm.
So it has three in development right now. I don't know which one's going to get made. I don't know if he's shooting one right now, if he's making this one called Trap or what. I have no idea. But it looks like we're going to get at least one new M. Night movie next year.
That's very exciting.
Yeah, he's
rocking
banging
them out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's very cool.
So what would your top five be? Your top five Shyamalans? If this is one.
This is definitely number one.
Which I love.
I would say Signs is my second.
Okay, love Signs.
Three, I go back and forth. Three is probably Sixth Sense.
Okay.
I know that's usually most people's number one, but that's fine. Four, I'm going to say Devil, even though he didn't direct it, but I think it still should count because I just love that movie. And
I liked everything until the reveal.
Okay.
And then I was kind of like, well, that's what I thought.
Sure.
You know, like,
I don't know. I had fun with it.
No, it the execution is really good. And I actually really like Chris Messina in that
movie. He's so good.
Yeah.
It's a good cast. It's one of those like super contained movies that gives you, I don't know, a lot with a small premise. So I don't know how well it holds up to rewatches, but I really loved it the first time I watched it.
Okay.
My number five is a harder spot for me to fill.
Okay.
I feel like it could be, some days it could be The Happening and some days it could be...
You're a Monster.
Glass. And I'm sure you're surprised I'm not saying Unbreakable in my top five.
No, it's fine.
I like Unbreakable a lot, but it didn't hit me the same way that the others did.
Okay.
I just feel like I have more of an emotional or personal connection to some of the other ones.
Okay.
And then The Happening is just like funny and fun.
It is very entertaining.
Yeah.
I'll give you that. I'm not to the point where I think it's like bad on purpose, which a lot of people claim that he's like trying to make like a kind of a shitty B movie.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not there yet, but
He does talk about bees a lot in it.
He does talk about.
So it's a B movie,
bro,
in that way.
Where are the bees going, bro? talk about Glass.
Yeah. So Glass, I felt like was a good culmination of the trilogy.
Okay.
That we didn't expect to be a trilogy of, you know, Unbreakable and Split and Glass.
Right.
I loved seeing the complete defying of our expectations at the end.
That is.
I know a lot of people hated that part.
Yeah,
I thought it was, I was clapping my hands in the theater.
Wow, okay.
I was like, oh, he did it. He went there. Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I just feel like it's such a fun take on a very, at this point, tired genre of superheroes and villains.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed all the performances. I thought everybody seemed like they were having a blast making it. Tonally, it goes a few different places that maybe it doesn't work 100%, I'll admit, but I really liked it.
I liked it more when I watched it on Blu-ray than I did the first time. And again, I'm sure that has to do with, similar to some other M. Night movies, like The Village, where it's like, I need to know what to expect because this movie isn't what I was expecting.
So you need to know what to expect when you're expecting.
Exactly. Great movie.
Sure.
Classic. So I liked it a lot more. I'm still not quite to the point. I like the defying of expectations to the degree that, like, we're told the showdown is coming.
Yeah.
And then we realize, oh, no, it's here. But the fate of the Bruce Willis character, I'm still not 100% sold on.
Well.
And that I think that's only going to be harder to watch now with his diagnosis.
I know. That does change things.
It does, it does. Right?
Fundamentally, it changes things. I mean, I watched the birthday, singing happy birthday video to him,
gosh,
which, like, broke my freaking heart.
Yes.
And then I watched The Sixth Sense and I was like, God damn it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we are losing a really great actor.
Yes.
A really great person. And
he's the man.
He's still with us. So it's, I don't want to diminish that.
Yeah.
He's still a whole person. It's just sad that, you know, he's dealing with all the things that he's dealing with. So, yeah, I mean, I get that. But
what's with M. Night's conspiratorial side?
Because
Glass has a huge conspiracy.
It does.
Old has a huge conspiracy.
Yeah.
The Village, to some degree, is about a conspiracy.
It is.
What else? I mean, those might be the big three, I guess.
I feel like The Happening is almost a little, well,
it's
not
pretty
exactly
straightforward.
It's fairly
straightforward.
Yeah. But
The wind is conspiring against us.
That is true.
Bro, we got to run away from the wind, bro. It's happening, bro.
Again, I think part of this, and it almost goes back to your mention of his treatment of, like, people with mental illnesses and stuff, is I think he's so influenced by, like, the 1950s, 60s sci-fi schlock and stuff that I almost feel like he, in some ways, doesn't necessarily update the elements that most people would update or leave out when it comes to that. You know, there was a lot of conspiracy and stuff in the air in the 60s and 70s, obviously, for good reason. It's a well that sort of never runs dry because there's always somebody out there that believes in something. And I think with Knock at the Cabin, you know, he also brings the internet into it, which has also awakened a huge subculture of people with similar ideas finding each other. And in some ways, I wish he had gone down that trail a little bit further in that movie. But yeah, I think he is fascinated by people who share a delusion.
Okay. I admire and respect his faithfulness to the power of belief, even if I don't always share it.
Sure.
Obviously, The Village is sort of about that. And you sort of framing it as a love story, you know, I think helps me then look at it as more about a belief in the power of, you know, love and our ability to heal one another and all that stuff. I don't want to say, again, too much about Knock at the Cabin, but I do feel like he could have almost predatorily fed on people's unwillingness to trust their own eyes. Because there are aspects of that in Knock at the Cabin in terms of, like, how much can I believe what I'm being shown or what I'm being told. And I think because of the world we live in, he could have really zeroed in on that. And I appreciate the fact that the movie is actually much more about, like, no, you should believe what you're seeing.
Yeah, that's true. I think, you know, one thing that I kind of struggled with watching The Village this time, especially the ending, was whether I think I'm aligned with M. Night Shyamalan's beliefs of what they should do at the end or what's going to happen. Like, I can't quite tell if he's endorsing the idea of The Village proceeding as it does or if he's critiquing it, because I lie on the critique side. But the more I see of his movies, the more I wonder if he's partly kind of advocating for it.
Interesting. Yeah, I didn't read it as an endorsement so much as a, I think it's true to those characters.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily know that they are an extension of him. You know, I don't know who his surrogate is in the movie. But I think the choice that they make is true to them.
Yeah.
Even if he's not necessarily saying, and this is the choice we should make.
Right.
You know?
I don't know that I would say he's literally saying we should all, like, go live in the woods, but.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. Because of all of his filmography taken together, there is so much about belief and spirituality and kind of questioning, you know, the norms of the world as we see it and as we live in it. So, yeah, I'm just curious how much of that reflects his own worldview.
I was a little bummed watching it this time that, like, some of the sequences early on, which should feel scary or suspenseful, I think are robbed of their power once you've seen the movie. Because you know that it's fake.
I don't know. I was still creeped out.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. See, I wasn't, because I was like, well, that's just...
I knew it, but I also was like, I still have, like, goosebumps watching it.
It's still well done. Yeah. Like, he stages it well. It's timed well. It's edited well. I just felt like I couldn't invest in it fully because I knew who was under the suit, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, it totally makes sense. I don't know. I still felt like there was a sense of peril.
Sure.
But, yeah.
Charlie agrees because I hear him yelling upstairs.
One other thing I'd forgotten, and this is just a complete side note, is I forgot that Jesse Eisenberg is in this movie.
He sure is. Early Eisenberg.
Doesn't say a lot, which is fine. Sorry, Jesse Eisenberg.
He's a listener. Yeah. Yeah, even the small roles are Michael Pitt and Jesse Eisenberg and Judy Greer.
Yes.
And I'm almost as big a Judy Greer fan as it gets. I will say, and maybe this is wrong, you could disagree with me because, again, knowing what we know, it makes sense. To me, there's something almost inherently contemporary about her. So seeing her in a period piece a little bit, I was like, I don't buy it.
Right.
And again, then we find out it's not the period. Yeah. It is contemporary. She doesn't know that. But she's very funny. Mm-hmm. And she's kind of like the comic relief in the movie.
She totally is. Yeah.
The smash cut to her crying is very funny.
Hilarious.
Yeah. Love Judy Greer.
I also loved that her character is named Kitty in this because that's also her character's name in Arrested Development. So.
Nicely done.
Yeah. I loved that. She's fantastic.
She doesn't flash anyone in the village, though.
Sadly, no.
Sadly.
That we know of. That may be why she's rejected by Joaquin Phoenix. We didn't see that part.
What? No, he would have embraced her fully had she flashed him. Did you watch her Hulu show?
No. I think I might need to, though.
Reboot, I think it's called.
Okay.
It's one season. It's already been canceled. Johnny Knoxville, Keegan-Michael Key, Paul Reiser, Judy Greer. They're rebooting, and Rachel Bloom from Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Yeah. They're rebooting like an old sitcom.
Oh, fun.
It's really good and sadly was canceled after one season.
Yeah. I will have to watch that because I love Judy Greer.
She's incredible. Yeah. Anything else about The Village that we want to mention?
I just want to highlight my favorite line from it.
It is farce.
That's not the one. No. It's when Ivy emerges from the woods and meets the forest ranger guy. And she says, there's kindness in your voice. I did not expect that.
Okay.
And I love that because it's, again, like it goes against all the things she's been told about the outside world.
Right.
That everything is something she needs to be afraid of.
Right.
And definitely something that was super relatable for me, like growing up in a super, you know, religious household. Meeting people that were not necessarily those who shared my beliefs and realizing, hey, they're like good, nice people.
Okay.
I've been taught otherwise.
Oh, okay.
And I just think, you know, having an expectation about people who have a different background or are coming from a different place, sometimes they can still surprise us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a good message.
Love it. Well, thank you for talking about this movie with me. It was awesome.
Thanks for inviting me. It was so much fun.
It made me like it even more than I already did. So
good.
I think it's number 4 out of 5 for me.
Sweet. All right. What's your number one?
Signs.
Okay.
I think it would go Signs, Unbreakable, Sixth Sense, Village, Knock at the Cabin right now.
Yeah.
So we'll see. Anyway, thank you guys very much for listening. As always, go to fthismovie.com every day for more fun F This Movie content. Make sure you go on Thursday to our YouTube channel because Rosalie's going to be on reserved seating this week. So check that out tomorrow. We have a Patreon that you can subscribe to and perhaps get more fun content. Go to patreon.com/fthismovie. Follow us on Twitter at fthismovie. Email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again, Rosalie.
Thank you.
It is farce. Thanks.
for listening to F This Movie.